Hey everybody, Kevin Rose here. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Kevin Rose Show. You're going to like this episode. If you're like me and a little bit of a health biohacker, longevity freak, or at least have interest in that area, there is a lot to learn about sleep. I first started getting into sleep here a couple years ago. I'd say it's probably been more than a couple years, but ever since Fitbit announced they were tracking sleep, or they created a portion of their app for that. I remember I was just kind of fascinated with it. But then the Oura Ring came out, and the Oura Ring is one that I've talked about on the show before, and it started showing me kind of really in-depth data about my heart rate, resting heart rate variability, and the different stages of sleep. And I noticed I was getting pretty low deep sleep. And so I reached out to my doctor, Dr. Peter Attia, started talking to him about it, and he suggested using things like cold, like a chili pad, to kind of cool you down at night to sleep better. And once you start going down a rabbit hole, I went pretty deep and started researching and reading up on the various studies that are out there. And there is a lot of data, especially in the last 10 to 20 years. And all kind of directions and all the folks that I was talking to, both in terms of physicians and scientists, they all pointed back to Matt Walker, who's a professor at Berkeley. He's a professor of neuroscience and psychology at Berkeley, and also the founder and director of the Center for Human Sleep Science. And he came out with a book that I dug into after it was recommended a couple times actually on this podcast, called Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams. And it's a book all about sleep and the importance of sleep. And there's just so much to unpack in this book, because even if you don't have issues with sleep and you think, oh, I sleep great, what's really interesting to understand is the effects that a lack of sleep has on our body, the immediate effects, like just in terms of our ability to defend ourselves from the common cold or various diseases or potentially cancer. I mean, there's a lot to unpack here. We cover it all. We talk about travel. We talk about melatonin. We talk about taking naps. We talk about the blue zones and what centenarians do, taking saunas before sleep, that some of this brain stimulation that you can do to actually potentially increase our deep sleep. And that's some of the research that Matt is currently conducting in his labs. Just really, really fascinating stuff. Super geeky. And we go pretty deep, but there's a lot to unpack and a lot to learn here. So I hope you enjoy this episode. But before we get started, I just wanted to say, if you would like to be on this show, and I mean that in terms of I'm going to be doing an Ask Me Anything episode, probably next episode, I would love for you to ask me your questions. And obviously this can be anything and everything related to the stuff I've done as an entrepreneur or product person or meditator or biohacker, or just anything and everything is on the table. You can email me at krs@kevinrose.com. That's KRS, like Kevin Rose Show, at kevinrose.com. We will pick through those and find the best questions. And there's obviously a benefit to asking your question in audio format, and we'd love to hear you. So if you want to ask your question in audio format, go ahead and just record any type of QuickTime file and attach it to your email, and then we can play it on the show. That would be awesome. So expect that in the next episode, and feel free to ask whatever you like. All right, so let's get into it. This is Matt Walker, author of Why We Sleep. One of the things I wanted to do to get started is kind of just set the stage. I think that there's a lot of people obviously know about the different stages of sleep, but I don't think they know to the level that you explain in the book. So I guess if you could just spend a couple minutes talking about the different stages of sleep, what they mean, that'd be a great place to start.
So human sleep is actually subdivided into two main types, as some people may know. One is called non-rapid eye movement sleep, or non-REM sleep, and the other is called rapid eye movement sleep, or REM sleep. And REM sleep is named REM sleep, not after the popular Michael Stipe pop band.
That's right.
But because of these bizarre horizontal shuttling eye movements that occur during this stage of sleep. And those two types of sleep, REM and non-REM, will essentially play out in a battle for brain domination throughout the night. And this sort of the cerebral war is going to be won and lost every 90 minutes, and then it will be replayed every 90 minutes. And that produces this standard cycling architecture of sleep, such that we start to fall asleep, we go into the light stages of non-REM, down into the deeper stages of non-REM, we'll stay there for about 50, 60 minutes, and then we'll start to rise back up again. And then we'll pop up and have a short REM sleep period, and then back down we go again, down into non-REM, up into REM.
Okay, so I'm curious to dig in there, because I've heard when you play with most of these fitness apps that track your sleep and things like that, you hear of like deep sleep, light sleep. Where do those fall in? Can you have deep sleep in both non-REM and REM, or does it have to be in one or the other?
It's only in non-REM that you have quote-unquote deep sleep. So non-rapid eye movement sleep is actually further subdivided into four separate stages, which are unimaginatively called stages 1 through 4. We're a creative bunch as sleep researchers. And stages 1 and 2, they're the light stages of non-REM. And then stages 3 and 4, that's the deep non-REM sleep. And it's sometimes also called slow wave sleep. Because if you look at the electrical recordings from the brain using EEG or electrodes placed on the head, you get these huge, powerful, deep brain waves that happen. They're very slow. They're only ticking up and down maybe once or twice per second. And to give you a relative sort of baseline, when you're awake, your brain waves are going up and down maybe 40, 50, maybe even 80 times per second. So it's a dramatic deceleration in brainwave speed. And that's why it's sometimes called slow wave sleep. But that's deep non-REM sleep, stages 3 and 4 of non-REM sleep. REM sleep is just simply REM sleep with a slight caveat. REM sleep can be subdivided into what we call phasic REM sleep and tonic REM sleep. Phasic REM sleep is REM sleep when you're having lots of these bursts of eye movements. And then tonic REM sleep is simply when you have REM sleep, but your eyes aren't moving back and forward. And so those are sort of two subtle differences in REM sleep. But for the most part, non-REM, 4 stages, and then REM, single stage.
Gotcha. And then in terms of what we receive out of these different stages of sleep, I mean, I know that your book goes into great detail on this, but is there a way to kind of like abstract out and just give you the top line of what it is that we can expect to receive in terms of benefits from those different stages of sleep?
Well, every major physiological system within the body and every single operation and process of the brain is enhanced by sleep when you get it and demonstrably impaired when you don't get enough. And one of the, I think, advances that we've made in the past 20 years is that we've started to hang different functions on those different stages of sleep. So I think the first take home to your question is that there is no one single stage of sleep that does it all. And sometimes people will ask me, you know, how do I get more REM sleep or how do I get more deep sleep? In truth, that's perhaps the wrong question. Mother Nature has actually understood and figured out the proportional relationship of these stages of sleep to optimally balance all of these different physiological and psychological processes. What we know upstairs in the brain is, for example, that deep non-REM sleep is essential to help fixate new memories into the brain. So essentially, deep sleep is going to hit the save button on new memories so that you don't forget. REM sleep, on the other hand, once you've kind of cemented those facts into the brain, it's REM sleep that then starts to collide them together in this fantastic sort of hallucinogenic experience, connecting pieces of information. It's sort of revising your mind-wide web of associations. So there's two different roles, memory association versus memory solidification. Solidification, non-REM sleep, creativity, association, REM sleep. For downstairs in the body, though, we know that it's deep sleep that does many of the operational benefits there. It's deep sleep that recalibrates your cardiovascular system. Deep sleep is perhaps one of the best forms of natural blood pressure medication that you could ever wish for. It's deep sleep that also resets your hormonal balance, particularly appetite-regulating hormones, so that you don't overeat the next day. And when you do eat, you feel full. Mm-hmm. It also regulates your metabolic profile and particularly the regulation of insulin and therefore glucose regulation. It also refreshes your immune system. And that seems to be, again, deep non-REM sleep. So I would say right now it's probably deep non-REM sleep, especially for the body. And then it's all stages of sleep upstairs within the brain and different functions are supplied or refreshed by different stages of sleep in the brain.
I got to say, one of the things that your book did to me more than anything else is pretty much scare the hell out of me. Because you cite all of these different studies that essentially, I mean, everything from just missing a single night's sleep is a big deal. And, you know, I live in Silicon Valley. We have this kind of like there's been this drive to produce and drive to work and execute, and almost like, you know, you're a hero if you go and work these crazy long, pull off these all-nighters. You know, that's like a badge of honor in some sense.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, like, can you talk about what immediately starts to happen? Like, let's say I do pull an all-nighter. What is going to be impaired, and what's going on?
So the first thing within the brain is that your ability to concentrate and focus starts to decline rapidly. In fact, after 20 hours of being awake, you are as cognitively impaired as you would be if you were legally drunk. And, you know, that's why sometimes it makes me wonder about those employees that you describe. You know, why do we overvalue employees that undervalue sleep? Because we would never look at an employee who is drunk all of the time and say, you know, what a fantastic employee and work for. But that's what we're doing when we're trying to survive on, you know, 4 or 5 hours of sleep a night, because therefore you're awake for 20 hours and therefore you are cognitively legally drunk in that sense. So that's the first thing. Your concentration starts to implode. Your mood starts to become unbuckled. And what I mean by that is you become much more emotionally reactive. You're much more pendulum-like in terms of your swings to both extremities, in fact, positive and negative. Your decision-making capacities begin to decline dramatically too. We also know that you become forgetful and it's harder to recall information, and you're considerably less creative. So certainly mentally, from that standpoint, it's non-optimal if your goal is productivity and efficiency and effectiveness. Downstairs in the body, we know that after one night of just 4 hours of sleep, not even total sleep deprivation, you see a 70% reduction in what are called natural killer cells. These are critical immune anti-cancer fighting cells. So after just one night of short sleep, you are in a state of really quite surprising immune deficiency. We also know that if you have a night of maybe just 4 or 5 hours of sleep, your immune system is so compromised in terms of fighting off viruses that you're about 4 to 5 times more likely to catch a cold. So the immune system starts to become dramatically compromised. We also know that your glucose regulation becomes impaired. So when you eat a meal, you have a spike in blood sugar, and that's quite dangerous if it stays high for a long time. It's non-optimal to have high levels of circulating glucose. And normally what happens is that your pancreas and beta cells in your pancreas will sense and listen for that glucose. And when they sort of pick up on that glucose signal, they release insulin, and that dramatically lowers the blood sugar. But those beta cells become muted in terms of their sort of listening capacity for glucose, and they stop releasing insulin. And so you actually become pre-diabetic.
Oh, man.
We know after 1 week of short sleep, your blood sugar levels are so disrupted that your doctor would classify you, in fact, as being pre-diabetic.
That's crazy. That explains, there's a bunch of things that I've tried to, you know, kind of being a biohacker, dig into on my own personal health. And certainly sleep has been one that I've been having challenges with. But the other thing too is, like you said, is the glucose side of things. So I'm not pre-diabetic, but one thing that we did notice is that when doing a glucose tolerance test, I don't dispose of glucose as fast as I should or as fast as a normal person would. So I don't have a problem with it spiking too high, but I do have a problem getting it out of my system. So I've used other things to address that, like doing more cardiovascular exercise, things of that nature, to get those muscles to be more sensitive. But I have not yet really thought about addressing or using sleep as another tool to combat that. That's really fascinating.
It is. And the data, to speak to your point, is really very, very powerful. And it's not just at the level of the pancreas. What you were describing there is not necessarily the release of insulin, but insulin instructs the cells of the body to open up these channels and basically sort of suck in the glucose and absorb that glucose. Even that process of glucose absorption is impaired. So you're sort of struggling on both ends of the glucose equation. You're not releasing enough insulin, and what little insulin you do release is not received by the cells efficiently. So the cells are taking in that sugar and dropping that sugar quickly. And that's why if you're on average sleeping 5 to 6 hours a night across your lifespan, you're about 200% more likely to suffer from diabetes.
Wow. That's crazy. I mean, there's a lot to unpack here. I mean, when you said you're 4 to 5 times more likely to come down with a cold, I mean, this explains pretty much all of my friends that are kind of new dads that, you know, they're up with their child and they're always coming down with something. I have a buddy of mine that gets sick like every other month and he just like always chalked it up to, oh, well, you have a kid, they're bringing in more germs. But in reality, that reduced sleep is making him more susceptible to these germs. Is that right?
That's exactly right. Yeah. Whenever you put people on a profile of sleep fragmentation, which essentially is new parenthood, which I think you probably know all about in the past couple of months.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. That's precisely what you see. The immune system really does just implode. And a good demonstration of this is during the flu season, when you get your flu vaccination, if you get that flu vaccination, but you've only been having 5 to 6 hours of sleep a night, you will only then go on to produce 50% of the normal antibody response, rendering that vaccination largely useless.
I love this point in your book. This was a great point. So you're basically saying, don't get your flu shot on a night where you had poor sleep. Maybe get a couple of good nights sleep in a row and then go in for your flu shot, and you're that much more likely to build up the antibodies and the resistance to that flu. Is that right?
That's precisely correct. Yeah. I mean, just think of the cost savings that we could have to the healthcare system. You know, flu season costs the American economy about $10 billion directly, about $70 billion indirectly. You know, vaccination by itself is a hugely costly thing. It's non-trivial. And we're wasting, you know, so much of that vaccination opportunity without knowing people's sleep. And this is where I think technology could be a salvation. If we could track people's sleep accurately, you know, and have an integrated system, Kaiser, and I'm just going to pick an example, could send you a notification and say, hey, fantastic, you had a great week of sleep. Now is the time to come in for your flu shot. I've booked you into a 9:30 appointment. Tap here to accept or just change. Or conversely, you haven't been able to quite manage good sleep this week. That's okay. Let's kind of reset for next week. Let's get a good week of sleep and we'll bring you back in. I'll reconfirm your appointment later on.
I mean, that's the future, right?
Yeah, I really hope it is. It's essentially, it's personalized medicine by way of this quantified self movement. I think it's incredibly exciting.
Yeah, I do too. One thing I was going to ask you, and I have no idea if this is applicable or not, but in terms of food allergies, is that not a response as well to something new that sleep could potentially benefit or no?
We actually don't have any data in terms of sort of that aspect of the immune system dealing with allergies, but it's almost impossible to find any component of the immune system, including sort of the inflammatory response, that isn't governed and dictated in part by sleep. So I think it would be a good candidate to explore.
Yeah, I was certainly thinking about, like, you know, if I'm introducing new potential allergens to my, you know, newborn, maybe do it after a great night's sleep or two, you know, but make sure they actually got a really high quality night's sleep the night prior.
That's right, because then you would have that full stock of the armory of immune devices in place, those that arsenal of sort of immune combating features, precisely.
Yes. So I guess, you know, I'll leave it to people to dig into the book, but it's pretty much everything horrible you could ever think about in terms of dementia and cancers, you name it, like it is linked to poor sleep. So I guess one of the things that I'm trying to figure out, and you touched on it a bit in your book, but like there's a very kind of subjective, I woke up, how do I feel? Do I feel groggy? But then there's also technology. And I would say that I have been testing out every single sleep-related device for years now, starting with the Fitbits and moving into the Oura Rings, and then also everything from an Apple Watch to I've had those things you slide underneath your mattress with a company called Rise. Being a scientist in this field, I mean, you have the absolute best equipment. When you think about consumer application of this type of stuff, so if somebody wants to just get a pulse on what's going on, do any of the wearables or any of the devices out there even come close to what you actually monitor in the lab?
Yes and no. So if you take high-level features of sleep, and what I mean by that is, for example, the total amount that you slept, maybe how many times that you woke up throughout the night, those types of features are quite accurately tracked by many of these wearable pieces of technology. The things that you sort of put under your mattress, they're a little bit more soft in terms of their accuracy. So commercial sleep trackers are doing well at what I would think of as the highest level of sleep assessment. Then once you drop down in terms of separating, let's say, non-REM sleep versus REM sleep, the ranges are sort of, you know, 60 to 70% accuracy if you look at the studies. Once you get down into trying to disambiguate deep sleep, stages 3 and 4 of non-REM, from light sleep, stages 1 and 2, that's where those devices really start to fail. And they're not particularly accurate at differentiating those stages from REM sleep. And REM sleep is also tricky to separate from wakefulness as well.
That actually makes me feel good because I was kind of freaked out because I was wearing the Oura ring. Have you seen the Oura? Have you played with that at all?
I have. Yeah, I don't have one myself, but yeah, I know of it. I've seen it.
I should put you in contact with those guys and get you their latest prototype. Their next one is going to be an amazing ring. But anyway, it scared me because I opened it up and my deep sleep was like next to nothing. And so you got to be somewhat concerned here because then you go and look at it, something like a Fitbit, and it says my deep sleep is in the normal range. And so I think that it's got to be a little bit frustrating for consumers and not knowing which data to trust.
Yeah, I do think you have to be a little bit careful. It can sort of turn you into the Woody Allen neurotic of the sleep world where you're sort of, you know, poring over these data. And there's no harm if those data are accurate. I think, you know, your valid concern here is when it's inaccurate, what do you do about that? There is actually a new disorder that came out recently called orthosomnia, which is where you're becoming too obsessive and concerned about sleep by way of tracking and metrics.
Oh my God.
I don't know whether it's going to become an official sleep disorder of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, but it tells you everything, I think, about where things are going. Will we get there in the next 5 years? I think we probably will. There are sort of headband devices that are coming onto the market. Those are tricky because of compliance. Most people take things off to go to sleep. They don't put things on. And so I think adherence and compliance will drop off with those devices. Mm-hmm. So I think you have to really think about touchless technology to assess sleep. And there may be new ways to do that in the future. So we will get there. I'm quite sure of that. But right now, I think for measuring your total amount of sleep, time that you're awake, and maybe REM and non-REM, you could possibly trust that. But the high-level features go with those and probably don't put too much stock into the others.
Is there any one that you recommend over others, or are they all kind of lumped into the same group of generally just okay type devices?
Well, devices that tend to be on your person, the Oura Ring, Fitbit, all of those devices, they all essentially are assessing your pulse and your heart rate. And from that, because non-REM sleep, REM sleep, and wakefulness have such dramatically different profiles of cardiovascular activity, they try to use that signal to discriminate the stages together with movement. Because when you go into REM sleep, which is the stage in which you dream, your brain paralyzes your body so that the mind can dream safely, so that you don't act out your dreams. So these devices will pick up on changes in heart rate together with movement and try to capture that paralysis. And those two signals, for the most part, are the signals that those wearable devices are using. Those are probably the best that we have right now. Things that are putting underneath your mattress or are not contacting you, those are a little bit more tricky. There's some radar devices that are out there right now that sit on your bedside. They may have promise too, but they also have directional difficulties, especially when you've got two people in the bed, etc.
Gotcha. What are the common signs that people that are deficient in sleep would be noticing in themselves? So they can wake up and say, you know, I'm kind of one of those people that I don't necessarily wake up and think to myself like, oh, I woke up 5 times last night. You know, that's not the case, but I can wake up and feel very tired. And then sometimes like a little bit of a tight jaw or stiffness there. So I'll know, oh, maybe I was grinding my teeth last night. So what do you think in terms of things that people should look for to think maybe I need to address my sleep and get serious about it?
I think probably the single easiest test is to ask yourself the question, if you didn't set an alarm to wake up, would you sleep past it? And if that's true, it means that you are underslept, that you're not done with sleep, and you still have a debt that you're carrying that you're trying to pay off, which, by the way, the brain cannot do. It can never get back all the sleep that it has lost. And so you can't try to oversleep at the weekend to pay off the debt that you've lumbered your brain with during the week. I think that's probably one of the best indicators. If, you know, there was a power outage and you didn't get that alarm signal, would you sleep past it? The second feature is, you know, are you sitting there at work reading a paragraph, for example, and you've read it now three times and you still just haven't really comprehended it. You keep having to go back and back. That type of inattentiveness is usually a sign of being sleep deficient. I think one of the other signs is probably if you're driving and, you know, you go through a set of traffic lights and you can't quite remember whether they were red or green. These are the typical reports that we get when we look at the studies with sleep deprivation and drowsy driving as well. I think your descriptions, though, are kind of elegant and they're even more subtle. You know, if you find yourself reaching for a third cup of coffee in the morning when normally two would do, that may suggest that you've had a deficient night of sleep. I would also say that sometimes it's only when you put the brain or body under load that you can expose the amount of insufficient sleep. So let's say that you try to work out. It's usually then when you start to realize, geez, this is a real struggle. I'm having a miserable day at the gym. Or, you know, if you're a cyclist, as I am, if I'm on my bike, I just know when my legs aren't working well. And I think, I probably just didn't have a good night of sleep last night too. So you can expose the lack of sleep in those ways. But the former are probably the more fundamental ways.
Gotcha. So if someone is wanting to start to think about what they can do to improve their sleep overall, you have a bunch of different natural remedies. I know there's so many people that turn to drugs and compounds and other things to try and address it. You're not a fan of drugs. And could you touch on that briefly and explain what the current suite of drugs have to offer? Is there any good in there and whether people should be taking them?
I'm not a fan of current sleeping pills. And I should note, by the way, it's not as though I'm anti-medication by any means. If medications work and they're good and safe, then I'm all for them. It's just that currently the sleeping medications that we have, firstly, they do not produce naturalistic sleep. And so both the older forms of sleep aids and even the new ones are a class of drugs that we call the sedative hypnotics. And sedation is not sleep. So all you're actually doing when you take those drugs is knocking out your cortex. Now, I'm not going to argue that when you take those drugs, you're awake. You're certainly not awake. But to call it naturalistic sleep is an equal falsehood in truth. The other problem, however, is that those sleeping drugs have actually been associated with a significantly higher risk of death as well as cancer. We don't quite know yet whether or not that relationship is causal or associational. For example, you could imagine that people who are taking handfuls of sleeping pills each week are people who've struggled with sleep all their life, and therefore it's the short sleep that they've been suffering all of their life that ultimately leads to them having a far higher risk of death and cancer, because sleep is linked to those things.
Like to your point earlier about having less natural killer cells, that type of thing.
Yeah. And in fact, I should note, by the way, that the link between a lack of sleep and cancer is now so strong that recently the World Health Organization decided to classify any form of nighttime shift work as a probable carcinogen.
Oh, wow.
So jobs that will induce cancer because of a disruption of your sleep-wake rhythms. In terms of the sleeping pills, though, we don't quite know if that's just simply associational, but it could equally be causal. We just don't know yet. In fact, I suspect that we will probably never know, because the weight of the evidence regarding the relationship between sleeping pills and cancer and death is now so powerful that any ethics committee would probably not let you do the crossover placebo study trial. Right. It may be so unsafe to do that. I think people need to be aware of that. The other thing is that they don't have to look to sleeping pills for help if you're suffering from insomnia, because there is a non-pharmacological approach that is currently available. It's called Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Insomnia, or CBTI. And it is just as effective as sleeping pills in the short term, but better still, once you stop working with that therapist, unlike sleeping pills, you can maintain that good sleep. And a study just published yesterday, in fact, showed that you get that benefit maintenance for up to 10 years after working with a therapist. With sleeping pills, unfortunately, as soon as you stop them, not only do you go back to the bad sleep that you were having before, but your sleep is often worse, and it's called rebound insomnia. So unfortunately, I'm not a fan of those sleeping medications at present, and I think people have not been adequately educated about their dangers and their sleep disruption qualities. So that was the chapter that I was really hoping to write, is to try and inform the public, and then they can work with their doctor and their medical physicians to see what their options would be. Because a lot of doctors, by the way, they don't know too much about sleep. If you look at the medical curriculums, doctors will, on average, have only about 2 hours of sleep education.
Yeah, it sounds like they're the same amount that they get on nutrition, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, these fundamental pillars. And it's a third of your life. It's a third of every patient's life for a doctor. But you only understand it from 2 hours of education, which seems strange to me.
That is just insane. So what are some of the spoilers for CBTI? Like, what are some of the things that they have you do if you were to go and take this type of therapy?
So they often provide what are typically sleep hygiene tips, and I can describe those. There are probably five core ones, and these are five things that everyone can do today to probably start getting better sleep. The first is regularity. So go to bed at the same time, wake up at the same time, no matter whether it's the weekend, the weekday, even if you've had a bad night of sleep. I know it seems counterintuitive. You'd think, well, I should sleep in late if I get the chance. Don't do that. Wake up early. Understand that it's probably just going to be a tough day. And then get to bed early that following evening and reset. So regularity.
Wait, you said get to bed early or get to bed at the same time as you normally would and reset?
Well, you can get to bed at the same time, or you can try to get to bed earlier that following evening. Getting to bed earlier that following evening is much better than sleeping late that prior morning.
Is that because you get more deep sleep when you get to bed earlier?
You will get more deep sleep, but it also just helps reset the body clock in a more powerful way. Whereas if you sleep late, what will happen is that when you wake up, let's say you've slept until 10 o'clock when you'd normally sleep, you know, until 7:30, you're then not going to feel tired at the appropriate time that following evening. So now you go to bed later, or worse still, you go to bed at your normal time, but you lie there for an hour or 2 hours, not being able to sleep.
Oh, I've done that so many times. I totally get it.
Yeah. And it's just that sort of that cycle that you get into. And so regularity, I think, is probably the most important tip that I can give anyone. The next one is temperature. And the advice here is keep it cool. I think many people probably have heard this advice before. Around about 65 degrees Fahrenheit is optimal, which sounds probably a little bit too cold for most people. If you want to, you can go to bed with socks on if you get cold feet. That's often a complaint with cold rooms. But cool it must be, because your brain has to drop its core temperature by about 2 or 3 degrees Fahrenheit to initiate sleep. So that's the reason that you will always find it easier to fall asleep in a room that's too cold than too hot, because the room that's too cold is at least taking your brain and body in the right thermal direction for good sleep.
And I'd been told by a physician that by sleeping at a slightly colder temperature, you do get more deep sleep. Is that true?
That is true. Yeah. There's been some remarkable studies, and we've played around with this too. You can essentially design what looks like sort of a wetsuit, which has lots and lots of veins in it that you can actually perfuse water into. So you can exquisitely control the temperature of any part of the body. You can manipulate the hands, just the feet, or the core of the body. It's crazy type of stuff, these experiments. And so they would start to play around with cooling of the body by perfusing it with warm and cold water. And indeed, they were able to find that when you were locally cooling the core of the body, but warming up the extremities, you were able to drop core body temperature and initiate considerably more deep sleep, sometimes between 20 and 30% more deep sleep.
Oh, wow.
Especially in older adults too. And older adults are where we see the most dramatic reduction in deep sleep.
Well, that's exciting.
But yeah, I mean, that's a wonderful, you know, potential anti-aging technology right there. So
there's two ways that I know to do this today. Well, three. Obviously, one is keep your room cooler and kind of sleep with less heavy bedding. The other thing is I've seen a couple of these devices, such as the Chili Pad and a few of these kind of comforters that you can get that either run air or water through them to kind of cool the body, which I thought was fascinating. I was wondering, have you used anything like that?
I haven't used the Chili Pad. I've heard much about it, and you know, the reviews, people rave about that. The data would certainly support exactly what those devices are trying to do. And you also mentioned just wearing less clothes. There was a study about sleeping semi-naked, and just that fact alone could actually increase the amount of deep sleep that you were getting too. So if you want to sort of promote that way of sleeping for whatever reason you choose, you also now have a scientific reason to suggest that that form of sleeping, it will help with that deep sleep. Yep.
That's great. One other thing too, a friend of mine happens to be on the board of directors of a mattress company called Sleep Number. they have a new mattress out that heats the feet. And he was telling me by heating the feet, it will drop core body temperature. Is that the case?
Yes. There have been studies with rats where they would actually warm the paws of the rats, and those rats would fall asleep quicker as a concept. I mean, I'm trying to visualize. I've always done this when I've read that study, thinking like, what exactly does that apparatus look like? You know, you're sort of cuddling these rats and then you're gently warming their feet, you know, and you're thinking, what am I doing as a scientist? But right. Yeah, that data seems to be there too. And it's slightly paradoxical, this idea. And by the way, the cheaper version of that is just have a hot bath. Most people sort of think that when they have a hot bath, they get nice and toasty, they get into bed, and that's why they fall asleep quicker. It's actually the opposite. When you get into a hot bath, all of the blood races to the surface of your skin, away from the core of your body. And then when you get out of the bath, you have this massive thermal sort of dissipation of heat. And so you lose an enormous amount of heat, your core body temperature plummets, and that's the reason that you have a sound night of sleep after you've had a hot bath. So you don't necessarily have to go to those extremes of, you know, warming your feet. But I think technology and, you know, mattress technology will probably be a wonderful vehicle through which we can manipulate sleep ultimately.
Yeah, I'm excited. I may have to go out and purchase one of these mattresses to see what it's all about. I guess, or I could just get a heating pad and put it on my feet.
Yeah, I mean, hot water bottles, you know, are a great thing too. Occasionally I will do that. I sound like an old man. I'm not too old, but yeah, I will heat a hot water bottle up, put it at the foot of my bed about 10 minutes before, and then get into bed, put my feet on it. And then within about 5 minutes, I make sure I kick it out, and it seems to help.
I got to say, one of the best nights sleep I've ever had in recent years was when I decided to have my dinner a little bit early. So, you know, let that food give it a chance to digest. And then I went to the sauna and did a late night sauna session where I just baked myself for 30 minutes, came home, you know, you're all sweaty, take a quick shower and jump in bed. And I was just in such a relaxed state. And I'm sure I was getting that same effect that you were talking about in terms of like taking a bath. And it was worked wonderfully.
I would love to have seen the data to see what your core body temperature was, I suspect. Although I don't think either of us would probably be excited of obtaining it because it's usually measured through a rectal probe. But let's put that aside for a second. I very much suspect your core body temperature was especially low that night. So, I mean, that's one of the problems, I think, with modernity is that we've got constant ambient temperature in our home. And it's a real battle. If you look at hunter-gatherer tribes whose way of life has not been changed for thousands of years, they tend to sleep in mud huts that allow free airflow. They tend to sleep with very little on them on hard ground. And if you look at how their sleep cycle is buckled in terms of when they start to fall asleep and when they wake up, it is in perfect synchrony with the rise and fall of temperature throughout the night and into the morning hours, even more so than light, actually, it turns out, which is another trigger of sleep or, unfortunately, bad sleep if you've got electric light. But temperature is just as powerful as light in terms of dictating your sleep-wake rhythms.
And I'm curious, we went through a few of them here. You said same in terms of the different tips for people. I wanted to jump back to that real quick. So yeah, you said temperature, and now you just touched on light. Are you a fan of it's dusk, I'm going to throw on my blue blocking glasses?
So those glasses actually seem to work. Now, it depends on which brand you're getting and the quality, but there was a study that actually looked at the application of those glasses. And what they found was that a hormone called melatonin, which normally rises with darkness to help tell your brain when it's time to sleep, there was a 50% benefit or 50% increase in the release of melatonin when you place those glasses on than when you were not wearing those glasses. So I think, you know, this is another part of modernity that has dislocated us from our natural sleep patterns. We are a dark deprived society in this modern era. And I think, you know, Thomas Edison has a lot to answer for in that regard. We know that light at night will put the brakes on that hormone melatonin. And you don't necessarily need all of the lights blazing in your house. So a good tip, if you don't want to start wearing those glasses, is in the last hour before bed, just dim down half the lights and try to stay away from those blue LED emitting screens. You'll be surprised if you were to sort of turn half the lights out in your house, you'll start to feel sleepier. It's really, part of it is psychological, but it's also physiological too. And we know this from studies where they took people and just asked them, you know, what's your normal bedtime? They tracked it, let's say, call it 11 p.m. And then they took them camping in the Rockies, and there were no electrical devices, no electrical light whatsoever. And lo and behold, they went to bed 2 hours earlier, and their peak melatonin was higher, and that melatonin started to rise 2 hours earlier than it did when these people were sleeping at home under electric light. So there's another demonstration, I think, of how you can manipulate your environment. You know, tonight, start tonight by dimming down those lights. If you use an iPad or a screen before bed for 1 hour, the studies demonstrate that you have about a 60% blockade of melatonin, and the peak of that melatonin will not arrive for 3 hours later than it normally otherwise would. You don't have the same amount of REM sleep either, and you wake up feeling less refreshed and more groggy as a consequence.
Yeah, I always go into the settings and turn on, you know, they have these settings now where you can basically get rid of the blue light. It is blue light, is that right, that we're trying to block?
More so. I mean, it's light on any part of the visible spectrum, but it's especially the short wavelength light, which is sort of the enriched in the blues, the cool blues. They're the most problematic, the most damaging to your melatonin. But all light is damaging to melatonin, but especially blue.
I see. Yeah. So I turn on that all in the settings, and, you know, my iMac and my iPad and iPhone and all of that. I also have the glasses. You know, you can buy those LED bulbs now that actually get rid of the blue light out of the bulb. Have you seen those as well?
Yeah, the Philips Hue lights are really quite interesting. And they were designed back in the day for NASA, in fact, because when you're up in space, you're orbiting the planet so quickly that you end up having somewhere between 18 to 22 sunrises every 24 hours, which sounds wonderful, you know, it sounds spectacular, but it plays havoc on your 24-hour, what we call your circadian rhythm. And so they tried to develop, you know, these constant natural light profiles within orbit. And at the time, those light bulbs cost around $300,000 per light bulb. So you can see the dramatic sort of decrease in cost nowadays. I couldn't imagine what the delivery time would be if one of those bulbs broke and you're up in space. Not too much fun. But so yes, I think there's another idea. You know, I think smart technology, the smart home, is really an opportunity for sleep. As long as science can help and is part of that discussion, I think we will be able to help architect ourselves out of the problems that technology has put us in to begin with. And, you know, this is a common theme. You know this better than anyone, that, you know, technology to begin with, wonderful thing, but then we see the problems that it can cause. And then it's technology that comes along to solve the initial problems that the prior technology instigated. And it's just evolution. We don't have to get too worried about it. I think some of my sleep colleagues are perhaps puritanical about it, about technology. That genie is out of the bottle and it's not going back in. So we can either find ways to work with technology and sleep rather than just simply try to, you know, shut ourselves down to it.
One of the things I heard you mention in the book that I thought was another little tip that people might not know about is this idea of not staying in bed if you can't sleep.
That's right. That's probably the fourth tip, which is walk it out. So if you have been in bed for 20 or probably, let's say, 30 minutes, either trying to fall asleep or you've woken up and you're trying to fall back asleep, don't stay in bed. The reason is that your brain is such an incredibly powerful associative device, and it will quickly learn the association between being in bed and being awake. And that's why sometimes people will say to me, you know, I was watching television on the couch and I was falling asleep, and then I get into bed and I'm wide awake and I don't know why. And it's because you've trained almost this sort of Pavlovian-like conditioning, the brain to thinking the bedroom is about being awake. So by getting up and going to a different room and in dim light, just try to read a book, no screens, no checking of email, don't eat, because that will train your brain to expect that. And only when you're especially sleepy should you return to bed. And that way your brain will relearn the association between your bed being about a place that you always fall asleep and stay asleep rather than the opposite. So that's a critical piece of advice as well.
Crazy. What about the big dietary offenders? This is the thing that really killed me about your book more than anything. It's like, I love a glass of wine with dinner and I love my coffee in the morning. Yeah, give people the bad news.
So everyone knows, I think, you know, caffeine is an alerting substance. It's what we call a psychoactive stimulant. I should note, by the way, it's the only psychoactive stimulant that we readily give to our children without regard, which is perhaps somewhat concerning. The way that caffeine works is that it blocks another chemical called adenosine. So from the moment that we all woke up today, this chemical adenosine has started to build up. The more adenosine that builds up, the sleepier you feel. And after about 16 hours of adenosine buildup, of 16 hours of being awake, you should feel plenty sleepy enough to fall asleep and stay asleep. Caffeine actually will come into the system and it will race on to and latch onto the receptors in the brain, these welcome sites for adenosine. And it will essentially mute those receptors. So the adenosine is still there. It's still building up every hour that caffeine is in your system. But your brain is unaware of that sleepiness signal because caffeine has muted that sleepiness pressure. And it is what we call sleep pressure, this buildup of adenosine. And the problem there with caffeine is that, as I said, the adenosine keeps building up. So when the caffeine wears off after several hours, not only do you go back to the same degree of sleepiness that you were before you took the coffee, you have that plus all of the additional sleep pressure that's been building up in between. And that's what we call a caffeine crash.
Well, isn't that great though for bedtime? What, don't I want a big adenosine, like everything to drop at the same time?
Well, you do. But one of the other problems with caffeine, however, is that you will have that crash, but caffeine is not cleared out the system within just a few hours. That's perhaps only the first 20 to 30% of caffeine. The half-life of caffeine is about 6 hours, and it's different for different people, and it actually turns out it's genetic based on an enzyme and the speed of that clearance. But on average, it's 6 hours.
Well, you should explain, the half-life doesn't mean that it's cleared out in 12 hours, right?
No, it doesn't, and that's the sting of the tail.
Most people think that about half-life.
Exactly. I think that that's one of the biggest misnomers, that you say, well, you know, after 6 hours, you know, it's only 50% of the caffeine remaining. That means that the caffeine is gone. It doesn't. In fact, a quarter of that caffeine is still there after 12 hours. So to put that in context, let's say that you have a cup of coffee at midday, then you go to bed at midnight, a quarter of that caffeine is still circulating in your brain. And so that would be the equivalent of tucking yourself into bed, and before you switch off the light, you grab a quarter cup of Starbucks, you swig it, and then turn the light out. That's not going to give you a good night of sleep. So when you put it in that context, I think people start to realize how far back they have to sort of scale down their caffeine use during the day. So I would say certainly 12 to 14 hours before you're expecting to go to bed, you should cut off caffeine.
What about those people? And I know we all have like one friend that you sit at dinner and it's like, you know, 10:30 and someone comes around and says, do you want any coffee? And they order like double espresso and then they pass out 2 hours later. Why? How is that possible?
So, how is that possible? So firstly, those people are usually working under a pretty heavy sleep debt. So there's a lot of sleep pressure in the system because they're probably only getting 4 or 5 hours of sleep. And it's part of the reason that they need a double espresso at 6 or 7 in the evening to make it through the rest of the evening. But we do know that there are some people who can fall asleep even when they've got caffeine on board. But there's another problem here. Even if you can fall asleep, the amount of deep sleep that you have when you have caffeine in the system is nowhere near as deep as that which you would have if you didn't have caffeine circulating as a cocktail within your brain. And that's why those people will perhaps wake up the next morning. They don't remember having a difficulty falling asleep, or even they don't remember waking up, but they still feel unrefreshed and they start reaching for 4 cups of coffee rather than 3 cups of coffee in the morning. And it produces this dependency, this vicious cycle. So you start drinking more coffee during the day to wake up, and then you don't get your deep sleep at night. So you need even more coffee the next day, and so on and so forth.
Oh, I mean, you're skipping a big part though, too, which is where people say, oh, I'm a little wired right now. I'm a little uneasy. It's 7 p.m. I'm having dinner. I'm going to have a glass or two of wine to kind of bring me back down.
I mean, I'm generally a deeply unpopular person overall just because of personality, but these things, these sort of cutting out caffeine and alcohol make me even more right. Unpopular. Alcohol, yes, it's probably the most misunderstood drug when it comes to sleep, perhaps that and marijuana. Alcohol, a lot of people turn to it as a sleep aid when over-the-counter medications have stopped working for them. And alcohol is another drug that sits within the class that we call the sedatives. And again, sedation is not the same thing as sleep. So when you take that nightcap and you fall asleep faster and you think, that's great, you're actually just going into a sort of a state of lightened non-consciousness rather than natural sleep. Alcohol has two more problems with it, though. Firstly, it fragments your sleep. And so you will end up waking up many more times throughout the night. Those awakenings tend to be so short that you don't typically remember them and commit them to memory. So you wake the next day not feeling particularly refreshed, but you don't remember waking up. So you don't join two and two together and right. think it was the alcohol.
Well, this is where a Fitbit or an Oura Ring comes in handy, because I've actually seen that. I'll drink, you know, a couple glasses of wine, and then you can just really see it showing these little small wake cycles.
Exactly. Yeah, it's sort of like your night is just peppered by these awakenings throughout. And, you know, we and others have done studies where sleep fragmentation, even if you're getting, let's say, 6 hours of sleep, but if it's 6 hours of fragmented sleep, it can be just as bad for things like mood and emotional regulation and impaired memory as total sleep deprivation. And that's been one of the big findings. It's not all about quantity of sleep. It's also about quality of sleep. But coming back to alcohol, the final part of alcohol's sad story when it comes to sleep is that it will block your REM sleep or your dream sleep, which is critical for a variety of essential brain functions. And so, you know, I live in the real world too, and life is to be lived to a certain degree. I think all I try to do is gift people with the science and the hard facts of what we know, and then you can make those informed decisions for yourself.
I'm curious, when you look at alcohol and caffeine in particular, when you think about studying populations of people that have been doing this for quite a long time, say it's the centenarians or the blue zones that are out there. Have you looked into that? And what is their typical consumption? Like, do they have alcohol every once in a while? Like, what is that? I'm with you. And I, you know, obviously we all have different social commitments and things that we have to do, both on the alcohol and caffeine side, or most of us do. For me, it's meeting entrepreneurs over a cup of coffee or tea or something like that. So I'm just trying to figure out, like, you know, what is the balance that I can obviously cut back and scale back, but I still want to dabble every now and then.
Again, I would love to say that one night or two nights sort of, you know, can be sort of passed up as non-problematic. But, you know, we know from the data that there's that 70% drop in natural killer cell activity. I could also tell you that all it takes is 1 hour of lost sleep to have an effect, because there is a global experiment that's performed on 1.6 billion people across 70 countries twice a year, and it's called daylight savings time. And in the spring, when we lose an hour of sleep, we see a 24% increase in heart attacks as a result.
Wow. Oh my God.
But in the fall, or in the autumn, when we gain an hour of sleep, we see a subsequent 21% decrease in heart attacks. So that's how fragile and vulnerable our bodies are to even just the smallest perturbation of sleep. So I would love to say that that's okay. I think the politically incorrect advice that I sometimes give to my students, I teach a big sleep class here at UC Berkeley, is that, you know, if you're going to drink, you should go to the pub in the morning, because that way the alcohol will be out your system by the evening. You know? But of course, you know, being a health professional and professor, I'd never say that, especially not on a popular podcast to someone like Kevin Rose.
So you're telling me brunch and champagne mimosas are where it's at.
That's the flag that you're hoisting. I will definitely salute that.
That's funny. What about naps? You know, I love a good nap. And I've heard that you say it's kind of okay, but you don't want to do it too late in the day. What's your take on that?
So naps are a double-edged sword, or they can be. And it comes back to that chemical that we spoke about, adenosine. So as you're awake during the day, you're building up all of that healthy sleep pressure. Well, when you go to sleep at night, that's when the brain starts to clear out and remove all of that adenosine, all of that sleepiness signal. So it's a little bit like a valve on a pressure cooker. It just releases all of that steam. And it takes about 8 hours of sleep to release 16 hours of sleepiness pressure. The problem with naps is that if you nap too late in the day, or you nap too long, you will actually release too much of that good, healthy sleep pressure, so that when it comes time to fall asleep at your normal bedtime, you don't feel sleepy or sleepy enough to get to sleep, mm-hmm. or you don't have enough sleep pressure to keep you asleep across the night. So that's where you have to be a little bit careful with naps. And I think the advice would be, if you can nap regularly and you don't have problems with sleep, naps are just fine. But if you are struggling with sleep, or if you can't nap regularly, or certainly if you can't nap sort of sometime in the middle of the day or early in the afternoon, then I would advise not going after naps.
Do you think they're beneficial though? Like, do you see populations that nap is having lower, you know, risk for all these types of things we mentioned before?
We do. Yeah. So we've done a lot of studies with naps at my sleep center, and they give sometimes just as much benefit as a full night of sleep. We've looked at this with creativity. We've looked at it with learning and memory. We've looked at it with the refreshing ability for you to store information. We've looked at it in terms of your ability for emotional regulation and even to be able to accurately perceive emotions in other people's faces, which is all about social intelligence and emotional IQ. So downstairs in the body too, we know that it's fantastic for the cardiovascular system, and people who nap actually nap consistently, this sort of siesta-like culture in the Mediterranean, they have lower rates of heart disease. There's a very sad study, in fact, done in the Greek population where they were about to outlaw, to do away with the typical siesta-like behavior in the afternoon. And the doctors and scientists advised against it because of the health benefits, but they said they were still going to do it because of productivity and efficiency within the workplace. So the scientists said, well, we'll track people and see if there's a consequence. And what you saw was almost a 40% increase in mortality caused by cardiovascular disease as a result of the cessation of napping, especially in males. And in working males, it was somewhere close to about 60%. So, you know, there you can see how naps can be protective and beneficial. It also comes on to perhaps a more fundamental question, which is how should we be sleeping as a species? You know, should we be doing what we do in this modern way of life, which is what we call monophasic sleep, which is one long bout throughout the night of 8 hours? If you look at those cultures that I mentioned, these hunter-gatherer tribes, they tend not to sleep monophasically, they sleep biphasically. So they have maybe 6.5 hours at night. And then they will often have, especially in the warm summertime, they will often have a short nap in the middle of the afternoon. And in fact, we all have this programmed into us. It's genetic, it's hardwired. It's called the postprandial dip, which simply means that after lunch, you have a dip in your alertness. Most people think it's because, oh, I had too much to eat or I had a heavy carbohydrate meal. You can actually stop people from eating and they still will have this physiological drop in their alertness. And I can measure it with brainwave activity, this dip. So it appears that Mother Nature actually programmed us to be sleeping in the afternoon, to be biphasic in our sleep rather than monophasic.
Have you looked into the population of centenarians and seen if they also tend to do the more biphasic?
We want to do that. We're desperately trying to. I mean, it's hard to get money for that work. We have a lot of work that looks at sleep, aging, and Alzheimer's disease right now. And we've been discovering how powerful the link is between a lack of sleep and Alzheimer's and accelerated aging. And we're developing or trying to develop new brain stimulation technologies to give back that sleep. But you can flip that question upside down and say, what about those people who seem to live a long life, and not just a long life, but a long, healthy life? What's the critical ingredient? And you mentioned the blue zones, and there's this huge, wonderful science of trying to look at what makes those people so special. Sleep has not been part of that conversation. And right now we're desperately trying to see if we can find, you know, any philanthropic support to go after these people. We can already see it in some of our cohorts. We've got cohorts of almost 200 older adults now that we track with their sleep. And we compare them to young, healthy adults. And of course, their sleep, one of the things that happens as we get old is that our sleep gets worse. It's probably the most demonstrable physiological signature of aging. But strangely, there is a cluster of these older adults, just a small cluster, whose, for example, the power of their deep sleep brainwaves is just as powerful as people who are youthful in their 20s. And you think, well, what is it? You know, is it their genetics? Has it been nature or is it nurture? I would love to find that out. It's just hard to get the funding and the support to go after that.
I thought you were going to tell me. I was getting all excited. I'm like, what is it?
Oh, no, I want to. And we've got those populations. We're just desperately in need of the funds to try and go after that. But can we not reverse engineer that question rather than exploring what's causing poor sleep and deficient sleep in aging, let's look at what actually allows the perseverance of good sleep and good health way into a later point of life. I think there are clues there with sleep that would be amazing. And, you know, we've done this, for example, in a slightly different version, which is with super memorizing individuals, these sort of mnemonicists who can just have this eidetic memory, this perfect memory. And we started to study their sleep, just a handful of them. And their sleep is not normal. They have, you know, almost 200% more of these particular brainwaves that we've looked at called sleep spindles, that are these spectacular bursts of electrical activity that help with the transfer of memory from short-term to long-term storage sites to protect those memories and help save them.
Yeah, you mentioned the spindles a lot in the book. Maybe I missed it. What stage does that fall in, or does it not? Or is that kind of bridging?
So sleep spindles happen during non-rapid eye movement sleep. We don't see them during REM sleep.
Okay.
They start to emerge in lighter stages of non-REM, particularly stage two non-REM sleep. They're a hallmark feature of that stage of sleep. But they keep going into deep sleep. And what happens is that actually, as you have these big, deep, powerful brainwaves of slow wave sleep, once you finish each one of those cycles of deep sleep, then you get one of these bursts of sleep spindle activity. It sort of festoons and sort of crests on the peak of the wave of that deep sleep brainwave cycle. And we think that together they form a file transfer mechanism for shuttling information, almost like shifting files from a USB stick to a hard drive. So, you know, I think what's going on here with people who are incredible with their memory? What's going on with people who are centenarians and who live a healthy life, not just a long life? So many fascinating questions with sleep. We just need to do the research.
Yeah, I would love to chat about how we could potentially fund something like that. It's certainly something I'm really interested in as well. One of the things I wanted to touch on real quick is a couple of things that I think we missed just a second ago. And I wanted to get your recommendation for, so if someone is going to nap, what time exactly, and for how long? Like, would you say an hour is too long?
I mean, in some ways, it depends on what you're trying to get from the nap. But if it's just a sort of a quick refreshment of focus, energy, and concentration, then I would usually recommend not napping for any longer than 20 to 25 minutes. If you want some of the deeper restorative benefits, for example, the benefits that we spoke about for the cardiovascular system, immune system, metabolic system, and we haven't yet spoken about the reproductive system, but there's benefits there too, then you would need to nap longer. You'd probably need to go 40, 45 minutes. And then if you wanted to finally get all the way into REM sleep, which is where you get some of those creativity benefits, often you have to go longer. You have to sort of get past that 40, 50 minute period to get into REM. So that's the duration of nap. When should you place that nap on the clock face? It depends a little bit on when you're wanting to go to bed and when you've woken up. But I would say certainly try to get those naps in at least 8 hours before you're wishing to go to bed.
Gotcha. And then in terms of like maximum time where you're like, this is too long, like hour, hour and a half kind of thing?
Yeah, the only danger with going that long in terms of naps is that you get something called sleep inertia, which is where you've gone, you know, far down into the deep stages of sleep. It's sort of that feeling that when you get a phone call in the middle of the night and you wake up and you just cannot go from 0 to 60 and make anyone believe it. You know, you're vaguely coherent. You don't quite know where you are for the first few seconds or what day it is or what's going on. That's that sort of heavy sleep inertia. You can suffer that if those naps are a little bit too long. So that's the one of the dangers. It will just take you, you know, about 60 to 90 minutes before your brain is up to operating temperature, not actual physical temperature, but, you know, in terms of functioning capacity, once you come out of one of those long sleeps.
Right. You touched on marijuana briefly, or you mentioned it. Have you done any studies in that space? Do you understand the impact it has on sleep?
So we currently haven't done any of those studies just in terms of getting funding for them. But those studies, there are quite a lot of studies now that have looked at this. Marijuana can certainly hasten the speed with which you fall asleep. So it's called your sleep onset latency. And you just fall asleep a little bit faster. The problem with marijuana, however, is that it actually does also block your REM sleep, your dream sleep. And if you continue to block dream sleep, it can actually lead to psychosis. So REM sleep is critical for our mental health. It's a stage of sleep that provides emotional first aid. studies have been done, for example, where for a week, you just selectively deprive people of dream sleep. You continue to allow them to sleep and get all of the deep non-REM sleep that they wish. But every time they go into REM sleep, you go into the bedroom and we wake them up. And you just keep doing that night after night. And you keep building up this dream sleep pressure. And at some point, people start to become paranoid. They become delusional. They start to have hallucinations. They see things that are not there and believe things that could not possibly be true. And in fact, if you continue to measure their brainwave activity, what seems to happen is that there is such a hunger for REM sleep within the brain that even though you're awake, the brain just starts to go into REM sleep whilst you're awake. So you start to dream whilst you're awake.
Wow.
And that's why you have that psychosis and the hallucinations. So that's one of the dangers of continually dosing with alcohol or marijuana. You start to sort of shortchange the brain of that dream sleep, and it builds up such a pressure that you can have mental health problems.
But does it block or interfere with deep sleep at all?
Not that we've seen, no. There are some studies that suggest disruption of deep sleep, but there are others that don't. So I think the data right now is equivocal on that point.
And in terms of breaking it apart into different, you know, molecules, I know that one of the things that is really popular these days is like the CBD, the non-psychoactive portion of marijuana. And there's certainly, I know probably several dozen people that take it in dropper form as kind of a microdose way to kind of just like relax and sleep better. Have you looked at the impact of that particular strain, that CBD compound?
No, those studies haven't been done yet. And it is an interesting idea, which is, should we throw the baby out with the bathwater? Because, you know, if it can help you fall asleep a little faster, but it comes with those sort of downsides later in the night regarding REM sleep, well, you know, is there a form of that which is optimal? It has the good without the bad. And I think that that's a good candidate right now. We just don't have those studies conducted either.
Yeah. In terms of travel, this is certainly something I want to touch on because it's something that anytime I go internationally, I struggle with. And my, you know, hack, I guess you wouldn't even call this a hack, it's probably a pretty blunt force instrument, is to go in and arrive in the new location, go outside, get as much natural sunlight as possible to hopefully kind of reset the clock and to the best that I can. And then when it's time to go to bed, if I can't sleep, you know, I do the standard kind of Ambien balm with maybe a drop or two of microdose of melatonin. Do you think that melatonin, I know you're not a fan of Ambien, but do you think of like melatonin as a potential tool and a toolkit for international travel?
Yeah, I think the evidence is quite supportive of that, that when you're traveling between time zones, that's when melatonin is effective. And melatonin, by the way, we mentioned it, but the way melatonin works, think of melatonin like the starting official in the 100-meter race at the Olympics. It gathers all of the racers together and it begins the sleep race. But the official melatonin in this case does not participate in the race itself. It just controls the timing of when sleep occurs rather than in the generation of sleep. And that's why we know that melatonin is actually not a good sleeping aid. It's not an effective sleeping aid. Now, by the way, I should note that for people who are taking melatonin and feel as though it's helping them, this is outside of the context of jet lag, by the way, just night to night.
Sure.
I would tend to say, because it's a very safe drug, I would say keep taking it because the placebo effect is probably one of the most reliable effects in all of pharmacology. And so take advantage of that. There's no harm, no foul. If you feel as though it's working, keep doing it.
You know, one of the things I noticed about melatonin is the amounts that you can purchase at the store, they vary so much from pill to pill, from manufacturer to manufacturer. And I actually found one that was extremely small, probably, you know, 1/20th of what a dose that you'd be when you go into the drugstore, that I just microdosed on my tongue. And I felt as though I had the same impact. Do you feel that people are taking too much melatonin when they do take it?
They are potentially, and not through their own fault, because as you mentioned, the amount in terms of over-the-counter melatonin varies widely. There was a study that was done that looked across about 27 different brands. And relative to what it said on the label, sometimes there was less than 20% of what it said on the label. And for other drugs, there was 600% more than what it suggested on the label.
Oh,
so
geez.
This is, you know, part of the problem with over-the-counter medications. So, but certainly melatonin, when it's controlled in a standard dose, it is effective for jet lag. And so what it helps is essentially tell your brain or trick your brain into thinking that it's time for sleep, when otherwise your body clock would not be expecting sleep for, let's say, 8 hours. Let's say if you flew from San Francisco to London and London is 8 hours ahead, you know, you arrive at Heathrow Airport the following morning and you stay awake throughout the day, which is what I would tend to recommend if you can. And then you come to bedtime, you know, everyone else is going to sleep, let's say 11 o'clock in the evening, but you're still 8 hours behind in terms of your body clock time. So you still think it's, you know, mid-morning, early afternoon. And that's where melatonin can be very helpful. It can rise the levels in your brain. And all of a sudden your brain thinks, oh my goodness, I thought it was just, you know, early afternoon. And now this melatonin spike is telling me it's almost 10 or 11 o'clock at night. I really need to time my sleep and it's time for sleep. That's how melatonin can be helpful. But there's probably lots of things that you can do to combat jet lag. There is no cure. We have not found a way to overcome this remarkable act of jet travel that fast forwards your body clock in a way that evolution never prepared it to face through time zones. The first thing that you can do is start to try and scale back your timing even before the trip. And I try to do this if I'm flying back home to England. If I'm waking up normally at 6:30, I'll start to in the week before go to 6:20, 6:15, 6:10. I'll just start to sort of dose myself back in terms of wake up time as if I'm trying to get closer and closer to natural UK time. Then when I get on the plane, if you're going to sleep, one of the biggest mistakes people make on long haul flights is that they sleep in the last quarter or even the last half of the flight. That's the wrong thing to do. If you're going to sleep on the flight, sleep early in the flight and then wake up and make sure that you accumulate at least 12 to 14 hours of wakefulness before you expect to go to sleep in the new time zone. So that's a good rule of thumb. If you think, okay, you know, I want to go to bed at midnight when I arrive in the UK, I need to make sure that according to the UK time clock, that I'm awake on the airplane by 10 a.m. UK time.
I see. So you're building up that sleep pressure, basically.
Exactly. So this comes right back to that story of adenosine again. I need to wake up and give myself at least 12 to 14 hours of wakefulness so that I'm going to feel nice and sleepy. And often you don't need Ambien then. It's going to be a tough day that next day, because most people tend not to sleep very well. And what I'm telling you is that you'll probably only have about an hour or 2 hours of sleep opportunity time. Take it, know that it's going to be a tricky first day, but then get to bed nice and early that following evening and you will get into set. That first night of sleep is so critical. It's okay when you arrive in the morning, let's say I get into Heathrow at 10 o'clock in the morning, to have daylight. And it's good and on that first day. But in the afternoon, even if it's not sunny, that's the time to put shades on. I don't want to expose my brain to bright light in the afternoon. So that's the time to sort of wear sunglasses. You know, you will look slightly awkward and rock star-like despite it being a cloudy day in London, but still do it. And that will help encourage the rise of melatonin again. So that's the travel night. That's the first day. Once you're then in that new time zone, people should know that it takes you, for every day that you're in a new time zone, your body will catch up by 1 hour. So it's going to take me about 8 days to catch up to UK time in terms of the 8 hour difference. But I can help myself with that. It's sort of almost like an extra pair of fingers on a wristwatch that pop out the dial and quickly speed it forward even faster. One of those things you can do is exactly what you described. In the morning, get outside and make sure that you get at least 30 to 40 minutes of natural daylight in the morning. If it is sunny, wherever you are, it's okay to put sunblock on or wear a hat, but don't wear shades. In the afternoon, reverse the trick. As I said, that's the time. It's okay to go outside, but that's the time to be wearing shades. And then on the flight, by the way, just to jump back, stay away from alcohol and caffeine. I know that they are both served liberally and often freely, especially when it comes to alcohol. Resist that temptation. Both of those things make it much more difficult for your 24-hour clock within the brain to adjust in the new time zone. And that's one of the other mistakes that people make.
Gotcha. That's all great advice. I'm like taking notes as you're saying all this stuff. That's perfect. Last thing I want to touch on before I let you go is some of the kind of what I consider future hacks that are starting to happen, future ways that we could potentially improve our sleep. I know that you mentioned in your book that transcranial dermal stimulation. Is that right?
It's actually called transcranial direct current stimulation.
Direct current stimulation. Okay. So is that TCD? I always get those confused.
TDCS. Yeah.
TDCS. Okay. So can you speak a little bit about that and some of the other kind of interventions that technology is providing and where they might take us and where they are today?
So that technology is something that we're quickly trying to develop. In fact, we have a spin-off, a new startup company called Stim Science that is trying to develop new stimulation technologies for populations in which sleep is deficient, especially older adults. The link between a lack of sleep and Alzheimer's disease in old age is now very compelling. And insufficient sleep across the lifespan is probably one of the most significant lifestyle factors determining whether or not you will develop Alzheimer's. And, you know, I have family members who are afflicted with the disease. So I'm desperately trying to find ways to stimulate that healthy sleep that adults are so, older adults are so bereft of. And what we're trying to do is essentially act like, I guess it would be like a choir, a supporting choir to a flagging lead vocalist, which is where you've got these sort of deep sleep brain waves, which become deficient, smaller in their size, less frequent in how much they're happening in older adults. And we apply electropads to the front of the brain, and we start essentially singing in time with those deep sleep brain waves. And by inputting a small amount of voltage, stimulating at the peak of each one of those brain waves, not only can you amplify the size of those brain waves, but in young, healthy adults, what we've demonstrated is that you can almost double the amount of memory benefit that you get from sleep as a consequence. So my hope now is whether we can translate that same potentially affordable, portable piece of technology into older adults and those with dementia. Can we restore back some healthy quality of deep sleep? And in doing so, can we actually salvage aspects of their learning and memory function?
Wow. Has those studies been done yet?
No, we're currently just starting to do those studies in older adults. In young adults, those studies have been done already. At this point, usually people start to think, okay, I'm going to buy one of those brain stimulators. You can buy them online. I would not advise you to do that. If you go onto YouTube, you can see the sort of the stories of where people have misaligned the voltage and they've got skin burns or they've lost their eyesight for several days. Don't try this at home, would be the advice. We're desperately working to bring this technology to fruition as soon as we can. And that's one of the other areas of sort of venture development that we're doing right now.
Yeah, I'm really curious about if someone that's otherwise healthy, you know, in their 30s and 40s, and they're starting to get into kind of mid and late life, if they can do something like that, and it would prevent, you know, something like Alzheimer's long term. Like, is it more of a preventative type thing that we should be thinking about doing now versus waiting until you have a sleep issue?
What a brilliant question. Yeah. And if you ever want to come and be a sleep scientist, just let me know. This is so it's a question that we literally just asked in the last couple of weeks. If you retrospectively or historically ask people how much sleep were you getting in your 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and you can sort of bucket the amount of sleep that they were getting across their lifespan. And we've done this with our older adult populations, older adults who we also have special types of brain scans that map how much of this toxic sticky protein called beta amyloid, which is associated with Alzheimer's disease. So we have how much amyloid is in their brain in their late life. And then we ask them about their sleep across their lifespan. And then we ask, at what point during the lifespan, what decade do you see sleep being most predictive of how much toxic amyloid has been built up in the brain? Is it that it's predictive across your entire lifespan? And the first answer is yes, that older adults who are getting 6 hours of sleep or less on average during their lifespan have a far higher risk of developing Alzheimer's than those who are routinely getting 7 hours of sleep or more. But where that sleep deficient sensitivity window seems to be during the lifespan seems to be somewhere between the 30s and 50s. That's where that relationship is especially strong. And that comes directly onto your point, and it's a very insightful one. Rather than trying to do late stage treatment, which is what we do with medicine right now, we don't have a healthcare system, we have a sick care system, and our system is designed for late stage treatment. We need to shift to a model of prevention rather than treatment. So could we start to actually develop these devices such that every night, just like brushing your teeth, you also have a stimulator that sort of gets you ready for that deep sleep, and it starts to provide a cushion physiologically to boost that deep sleep at that window of sensitivity that we know matters most, and it staves off the onslaught of Alzheimer's disease. That's, I think, where we're trying to move and head towards as well. That would be exciting.
Yeah, I'm curious, when you do boost that stage of sleep, what are you improving at that point? Are you improving accumulation of beta amyloid, or are you improving the clearance of it?
So both, actually. So what it's during deep sleep at night that we've discovered that the sewage system in the brain, we all know that we have a sewage system in the body, it's called the lymphatic system. It was only about 5 or 6 years ago that we discovered that the brain has a sewage system. It's called the glymphatic system, after the cells that make up this system called glial cells. And that sewage system in the brain is not switched on at high flow volume all the time during the 24 hours. It's during sleep, and specifically deep sleep, that cleaning system actually kicks into high gear. And one of the toxic metabolic byproducts that deep sleep actually washes away at night is beta amyloid, the Alzheimer's protein.
One question there, is that new incoming beta amyloid, or is it if you were to improve deep sleep, could you see a reduction in beta amyloid in a brain? Or once you have it, is it always sticky and is it always there?
Right now, we suspect it's the latter. We only have evidence of the former. What I mean by that is we don't have any human or even animal studies right now that demonstrate that once those beta amyloid deposits are within the brain, that deep sleep can go after them and wash them away. That seems to perhaps be too much of a high bar task for sleep to accomplish. But what sleep can do is simply clear the toxic protein that has been building up during the day, because it turns out wakefulness is low-level brain damage, and that's a biological fact. So I think it's right now, it's really about preventing that accumulation from ever taking place rather than perhaps removing what has built up at that stage. But that right. said, I still hold out hope. Maybe that can occur. I think that pathologically, that's a very difficult challenge for sleep to face. I think that would be Herculean and perhaps just too much. But that, I think, is why your question is so exciting to me. If we can start to intervene with sleep early on in life, maybe we never have to face that Alzheimer's equation, or at least we face it at a far lower risk and probability. Because, by the way, your sleep starts to decline, not in your 70s or even in your 50s. We can see the decline of deep sleep beginning in your late 20s. That's when we can start to pick it up. And then it just escalates thereafter. You know, wow. By the time you're in your 50s, you have about 50% left of the deep sleep that you had when you were in your 20s. By the time you're 80, you have maybe only about 5% left. And by the time you're 90, on average, we can't detect any deep sleep.
Wow. So this is a huge potential opportunity for you. I can see why you have a startup going forward. If people wanted to, is there anything that the folks listening can take part in? Like, are you doing any types of trials with brain stimulation, or is the startup going to produce a product anytime soon?
So we're right now sort of developing the hardware and the algorithms and the electrical stimulation profiles optimally for that. And once we develop that, then we'll be doing pilot studies, carefully controlled placebo crossover design studies, to really make sure that it works. I know there are lots of gadgets out there that claim to do this, but we're going to do this scientifically. You know, my parents, for example, are in their mid 70s, and I would not wish them to spend their good money on a product that doesn't actually work. It's snake oil. That's not the business that we're in. I think it's unethical. So we're desperately going to try and do it. If it takes us several years, so be it. But our preliminary data so far looks encouraging, but we've got a lot of work to do.
I'm curious, in the initial data that you do have, is this something where it is beneficial? Obviously, it's beneficial as it's happening, but is there any kind of staying power? So let's say you do brain stimulation one night and you sleep the second night. Is there some type of factor in terms of like plasticity that is occurring, that it creates a beneficial effect even when you're not doing it going forward?
It's a wonderful question again. And that's a possibility. We don't have the data yet to look at that for sleep, but it's almost, you know, comes back to your idea of microdosing. You know, if you get up to a dose to begin with, then all you perhaps need to do is just top it up every now and again and maintain that asymptotic level. The reason I suspect that that may be possible is that if you look at other brain stimulation techniques where they stimulate the brain during the day, perhaps over the part of the brain that controls your motor movements called the motor cortex, you can stimulate there, and the benefits in terms of your motor skills can actually last for several days after just one sort of serving of brain stimulation. So I think that that's another area, you know, would you really need to be stimulating each and every night? Could you not sort of get the brain, perhaps through mechanisms of plasticity, up to cruising speed? You know, it's like a car. Once you get it on the freeway and you've revved through the gears, you know, it just requires a little bit of feathering on the gas pedal to keep that momentum going. That's, I think, a possibility too.
Yeah, this is all such a really exciting field. And something that I feel like you are on the very, very tip of. It feels to me, I don't know if you feel the same way, but it feels to me in the last couple of years that people are starting to really take their sleep seriously or start to really care about it and ask these deeper questions, especially as these more, you know, smart devices that we get on us give us some insights into how we're sleeping. You start to ask more questions, which is, I think, great in terms of consumer demand for a future product like this.
I think sleep awareness is growing. I think we've still got a long way to go. And I think people like myself are to blame for that. You know, I've known of the science of sleep for 20 years. And, you know, that's part of the reason I was compelled to write the book, because I just didn't feel as though the public had been united with the data that's so plentiful. I think we are with our sleep neglect where we were with smoking 50 years ago. You know, we had all of the science to tell us that it was deathly and carcinogenic and problematic for cardiovascular disease, but the public had not been informed. And it's taken us this time to actually eradicate so many aspects of that. I still feel as though we're there with sleep. I think awareness is growing. But, you know, if you look at the data back in 1942, the average American adult was sleeping 7.9 hours a night. Now that number is down to 6 hours and 30 minutes on average. And so, you know, it took Mother Nature 3.6 million years to put this necessity of 8 hours of sleep in place. And then within the space of 80 years, we've come along and lopped off 20, 25% of that. How could it not result in deleterious health, disease, and sickness as a consequence? That's exactly what we're seeing. And I hope that through awareness and the quantified self movement, people start to become fascinated by sleep, tracking sleep. You know, we say in medicine, what gets measured gets managed. And I hope that we can start to bend the curve of our great sleep depression back on itself in an upward direction. We desperately need to.
Yeah, absolutely agree. And I will say that your book, Why We Sleep, it's available everywhere. We touched on, you know, probably like 8% or 2% of the overall amount of studies that you cover and all the different data that you provide in there. And I thought it was a great read for someone that's really excited about this stuff. And there's some really, really good practical tips in there in terms of other little things you can do to improve your sleep. So, well, thanks for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And thank you for speaking the good word of sleep by way of this podcast. I'm going to grant you the title of being a sleep ambassador now, Kevin. So thank you so much for doing that.
Amazing. Do I get like a little badge or plaque or something? That'd be great. Or maybe even just like a session in your sleep lab would be awesome.
Absolutely. Any one of those I will definitely provide, or all of them perhaps.
Okay. And then last thing, where can people find you online if they want to? I mean, obviously they can get your book on Amazon, but what about tracking all the stuff that you're up to?
Yeah. So I'm all over the web at Sleep Diplomat. So website sleepdiplomat.com, and I'm on social media in terms of Sleep Diplomat as well. So that's where folks can find me.
Great. Well, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks so very much again.
That's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. It's going to be difficult to cut out caffeine. I think that one for me is probably, no, I would say, you know, it's a double whammy because you got to do caffeine and alcohol. I don't know how I'm going to actually dial back. I know that now that we've listened to this episode, I'm trying to think how I can slowly scale back. And I think if I move to mostly green tea and then slowly, you know, every other day, do no caffeine, that might work for me. It's going to be tough, but I'm going to get serious about tracking this stuff and continue to try the variety of different devices, especially the new Oura Ring that's about to come out, and let you know in my newsletter some of the little improvements that I find and that, based on the hacks that I do. I'm definitely going to try sauna before bed.
and heating up the feet as we spoke about. But anyway, stay tuned. You'll learn more about all my little mini micro experiments in my newsletter. You can sign up there, or you can sign up for the newsletter at thejournal.email, or just head on over to kevinrose.com. And there's a newsletter tab. You click on that, put in your email, and you will get my once a month free newsletter. Join over 100,000 people that are now subscribed. And the last thing, and this is the biggest thing, I would say even more so than the newsletter. Well, the newsletter is pretty big too, but if you want to really help out this show, the number one thing you can do is leave us a 5-star review on the iTunes store. Head on over there. Or if you're a Google person, the Google Play Store as well, or Spotify. I don't know if you can leave reviews on Spotify, but wherever you receive your podcasts, head on over there, leave us a 5-star review. And I do that not because I want the vanity of a 5-star review, but really because it feeds back into their recommendation engine, which means that this podcast will be recommended to more people. And the more downloads we get, the better guests we have on the show. So that helps out. All right, that is it for this episode. As always, full show notes available at kevinrose.com. Be well.